everyone, and welcome to a very special episode of Climate Queens. This is our first video recorded episode to celebrate the Arts and Human Rights Festival presented by Frontline Defenders and the Smashing Times. They have partnered with some incredible organisations such as Fighting Words, TROCRA, Amnesty International, the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, and the National Women's Council of Ireland. The festival is packed full of incredible workshops, talks, and important conversations, and we are so delighted to be part of it. So for those of you who have listened to our summer episodes, you'll know that we partnered with the team at Frontline Defenders to bring you three conversations with three incredible human rights defenders. We have absolutely loved using our platform to elevate the voices of those fighting on the front lines of our climate crisis. And today is no different. Today, we are joined by two remarkable women, Mariam Sawadogo, who you might remember from our episode with Joseph Rahel. Mariam is the Frontline Defender Protection Coordinator for Central and West Africa. And from speaking to her on numerous occasions, we have learned that Mariam does not sleep.
Not
at all. The amount of work that Mariam does is unfathomable. So we are so delighted that she has given us this next hour of her time to speak to us today.
We are also joined by Clodagh Daly. So just to get this out of the way, I'm Clodagh Climate Queens. And then we have Clodagh Daly, who's come as a research assistant with the Effective Nature Laws Project, which is based in UCD. And she voluntarily coordinates the Climate Case Ireland campaign. So Climate Case Ireland is the second case in the world, just to preface, in the world, in which the highest national court of law has required a government to increase the ambition of its climate policy. And it sets a landmark international precedent for courts around the world to follow. And so we have been following Climate Case Ireland for a while, very closely. So we are honoured that Clodagh has decided to join us today and we can pick her brain a bit. And we really can't fully express how excited we both are to have you here today. So welcome to our honorary Climate Queens, Mariam and Clodagh. Hello.
Hello, Climate Queens. How are you doing?
Good. So we might start speaking a little more about what you both do. Maybe Mariam will start with you. So we spoke to you about your work in the last episode, for anyone who listened to the Joseph Rahel episode. But maybe you could give us a brief introduction about your role with Frontline Defenders and the type of work that you do in West and Central Africa.
Thank you, Chloe. So as you mentioned earlier, my name is Mariam Sawadogo and I'm the Protection Coordinator for West and Central Africa. I'm based in Senegal in West Africa. My role within Frontline Defenders is to be the bridge between human rights defenders and the organization. So the PC role, as we usually say, is a transversal role, meaning that I intervene externally, but also internally. Externally, I serve as the entry point to the organization. This means that we are regularly in contact with human rights defenders. The human rights defenders, they contact us directly, or we receive cases from other international NGOs or local NGOs who think that our support could be beneficial to the human rights defender. It also happens to us to see directly cases which we see in media because we also do a lot of media monitoring. And the PC is also the contact person for any kind of collaboration or coordination work with other international NGOs. So this is the external role of the protection coordinator. Internally, the protection coordinator is also transversal because the PC is the person, other department from the within the organization, other program within the organization will reach out to get more information on a specific country. It's the PC who provides regional and country analysis to the organization through many outputs that we have, such as the global analysis, and also provide lists of human rights defenders that are in need to be trained. Frontline defenders also rely on the PC for the verification of grant application that we receive on the field. So basically, this is the role that I have, and this is what the PC role entitles to.
Is that all? Wow, that's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing. And maybe Clodagh, we'll go to you next, just for a quick intro. So maybe could you tell us about how you came to be involved with Friends of the Irish Environment and the Climate Case Ireland campaign, maybe just a bit about their work and your role within the organisation?
Yeah, sure. Thanks so much for having me. And it's such an honour to be a guest speaker alongside Mariam. He's doing such incredible work.
Yeah.
So I came to be involved with the organization. It was kind of it was very informal. Basically, the case was launched in 2017. And when that happened, one of the Dutch lawyers who brought the first climate case in the world actually traveled to Dublin to talk about the Dutch climate case and what the implications of their victory had been in the Netherlands and what it could look like for Ireland. So I went to a talk that Dennis Van Berkel gave, and it was just so inspiring to see how the law could be used in such a creative way. And so after that talk, there were maybe 12 of us that met afterwards, including people from Friends of the Irish Environment, Tony Lowes, the founder, and Andrew Jackson, who is the solicitor for the case and who really kind of had the vision to, you know, decide that a case like this should have a public campaign as well, that people should feel involved in the case as much as possible. So we kind of had a brainstorming session that day, but it was a while before the campaign actually was, you know, taken off the ground because we didn't have a hearing date for the High Court. We had permission to go, but we didn't know when. And so when we knew that we would be, that our case would be heard by the High Court in January 2019, we started the campaign really like in October of 2018. So yeah, that was how I came to be involved. And it was, yeah, there's an amazing team of volunteers that are behind all this work, though. And it's still very much ongoing. At the moment, we are trying to organize a series of webinars, very much inspired by your own brilliant work, and trying to take advantage, I suppose, of the fact that we can, in this way, access speakers that we normally wouldn't have been able to. So that's one of the positives coming from the lockdown situation. But yeah, so that work is still ongoing. And we've been looking at the new climate bill with great interest as well. That just came out a couple of days ago.
It's literally fresh off the press, like 2 days ago.
Yeah.
But that's kind of, I think that kind of brings us nicely onto the next question, which is, I suppose, just to kind of hash that out a bit more and understand that initial journey and the initial spark, you know, when you brought the case against our Irish government, you know, where, you know, all the way to where our government had to draw up a new climate bill. Like, that's huge. So could you kind of take us on that whole journey? What did you guys do? Where did that spark come from? And you're obviously, as you said, inspired by the Urgenda case, which was phenomenal and so great that you got to actually hear from them directly. But could you kind of take us on that journey, Clodagh, and explain to our listeners who maybe haven't heard about Climate Case Ireland before?
Yeah, for sure. So I am not the lawyer at all. Like, with Climate Case Ireland, I'm just involved in the campaign. But basically, the Dutch climate case was brought by an organization called Urgenda back in 2015. And it was the first case in the world that successfully challenged the government's failure to reduce climate, to abide by its own standards that it had agreed were necessary to protect its citizens from the worst impacts of the climate crisis.
Yeah, it's just gone. No,
there's only room for one cloud, apparently.
Yeah.
The internet says no.
Oh my gosh, no, Clodagh, come back.
Come back. Well, maybe Clodagh will come back in a minute. So Mariam, maybe we'll ask you a question. Oh, I hope maybe she'll come back. Maybe Clodagh can hear us and we can't see her and she's going to come back in.
Just going to jump back in.
Yeah. So, Mariam, maybe we move away from Clodagh for a minute, and we just want to get your thoughts. So we are like from, we'll go back to Clodagh about the Climate Case Ireland, but we are seeing groups all over the world that are, you know, suing their own governments, which is really inspiring to see people take action like this. So it's over like inadequate action on climate change, really. So maybe in your opinion, how could the law help protect human rights over the years? Like, would a movement be effective in Sierra Leone, perhaps? What do you think?
Thank you. I may start by saying that the singularity and beauty of the law lies in the fact that it's evolving. You know, the law is not something that is static. It adapts a lot to the change, to times. And I really think that in the African context, the law can be a strong ally to in bringing a change in behavior. But it requires the involvement of governance and political decision makers, unfortunately. If the laws are passed at the top of the state, we will, of course, see the effects among the people because, you know, no one is supposed to ignore the law. And as we will move towards, you know, a strong commitment from governments, having strong policies in all the sections of the society, we will then be able to perceive the effects of, you know, the law as an ally to achieving the change in behavior we are seeking.
And have you found, Mariam, like, are there any examples that you have in terms of how the law has helped and supported citizens in Sierra Leone, maybe specifically to do with the climate crisis or not even, you know, because I suppose what Clodagh will hopefully explain to us at some point is that we can use the law to affect change. And I'm just wondering if you've got any examples, or is it a case that, you know, is it something that you're experiencing in Sierra Leone where it's corrupt or it's not working in favor of the people it should be? Do you have any examples that you could share?
Once again, well, in Africa, we can obviously have the laws, you know, protecting and promoting climate change and change of in behaviors. But of course, it needs more than, you know, it's not only just about the law. For example, in many of West African countries, we had parliaments, members, and governments adopting laws to ban plastic bags because they are, you know, not good for the nature, for the environment, etc. But once again, those laws are adopted. In practice, they are really good. They are amazing. You know, in theory, sorry, they are amazing. But in practice, there's still the lack of implementation. Mm-hmm. And this is where we are really struggling because it's not just at the level of just adopting a law, but the implementation that will follow. I think this is where we can achieve, you know, big change, implementing the laws that we have and follow up, because we don't do follow up a lot. We tend to just adapt the laws and put them in, you know, on the desk, and then move to another topic, and then and whenever there is a problem, they will see. But see, we adopted this law, but what about the implementation, the follow up mechanisms that we will put in place to ensure that this law is efficient?
That's exactly kind of where we're at now in Ireland with, hello, Clodagh, welcome back. Can't ignore the fact that you've just popped back in.
I'm so sorry. No more interruptions now.
Sorry. Oh, it's fine. Don't worry. We kept the conversation going with Mariam anyway. She was just saying that, you know, it's all well and good to kind of put laws in place, but, you know, implementation is extremely important. And I think that kind of nicely links back into where you were talking. You know, we are at the stage now where we have a climate bill, but obviously implementation is key. But you were in the middle of telling us about Urgenda and that kind of HUD experience and what they initially did, being the world's first group to kind of do what you guys did. So would you like to continue where you left off?
Yeah, And I suppose that actually ties in quite well with what I was going to say, which is, you know, why try and use the law as a tool at all? Like, why turn to the courts? And it is because of that. It's because our political system has consistently failed us. So since the, you know, International Environmental Treaty, the United Nations Framework Convention for Climate Change was created way back in 1994, governments from around the world have been meeting every year at these big climate conferences, and every year they convene and they agree how far we are from where we need to be, how devastating the consequences will be of not meeting our agreed targets, and how cost effective it would be to take action early. The government has known about the impacts of the climate crisis for a very long time. And basically, we wanted to demonstrate, we wanted to hold them really properly accountable and showing that they actually have, you know, a legal obligation to protect citizens from the worst impacts of the climate crisis, that this isn't, you know, a future issue, but that its impacts are already being felt right now, and that Ireland, although it's a small country, contributes disproportionately to this problem and has repeatedly agreed that we should be actually taking the lead.
So, we're just the worst.
yeah. Our ecological debt is so much higher than that of other countries. But our lawyers decided that when the 2017 National Mitigation Plan was published by the Irish government, that it was unlawful because instead of actually mitigating Ireland's emissions, it would allow Ireland's emissions to increase. And this is despite the fact that under that international treaty, the UNFCCC, the Irish government had repeatedly agreed that Ireland should be reducing its emissions by at least 25%, if not 40%, and that our emissions would instead be increasing under this plan by about 10%. So not even just that they'd be leveling off, but they'd be actually increasing. And so our legal team claimed that this was a violation of citizens' constitutional rights. So the right to the right to life, the right to bodily integrity, and the unwritten constitutional right to an environment consistent with human dignity. And then we also relied on the European Convention on Human Rights, so the right to life, family life, and property. And we also said that it was in violation of Ireland's 2015 Climate Act, which has the draft of that amended bill has just been published. That's what we were just talking about earlier. So we said that by not specifying how emissions were going to be reduced, the government was in breach of that act as well. And we also said it was in breach of the Paris Agreement. It's kind of, you know, a strategy of not putting too many of your eggs in one basket. When you're bringing a case like this, you don't want to be relying too heavily on one argument. So yeah, it was quite a, quite a few arguments that were brought forward. So that was the thinking. And yeah, at the time, the Urgenda case had won at the first stage, but the Dutch government had actually appealed that decision, despite being, you know, pleaded to by their own citizens and from people around the world. The Dutch government decided to appeal the decision. So they took the Urgenda case back to court and said that they shouldn't be required to reduce their emissions, but they lost again. And when they lost for the second time, the Urgenda case actually had succeeded in getting the court to acknowledge that the European Convention on Human Rights should be protecting Dutch citizens from the climate crisis. And so the same arguments that we were trying to rely on had been successful in the Dutch case. So there were all of these, different stages throughout the journey. We had our hearing in the High Court in January of 2019. It was a four-day hearing, and honestly, it was just so incredible. One of the papers described it as a festival vibe. There were just people from all walks of life. There were grandparents there with their grandchildren. At one point, class of kids aged about 11 walked in and just sat on the floor and just silently watched the proceedings happen. There were delivery drivers, there were engineers, there were artists, there were breastfeeding mothers. It was just really, really remarkable. And even on the last day, the judge had to actually interrupt the proceedings to ask people sitting in the aisles to shift up towards his desk to let more people into the room. So it was really, really amazing. And I think especially because one of the arguments that the state had put against our case was that Friends of the Irish Environment as an NGO shouldn't have the right to bring the case. So normally in rights-based cases, you can only pursue kind of the protection of your own rights. So for example, Katie, if you were to be hit by a car and were to break your leg, I wouldn't be able to take a case on your behalf.
Touching wood. So,
I would try. But there's been just some progress in recent years to try and give environmental NGOs space to bring these cases, because it's acknowledged that obviously the environment can't defend itself necessarily, and also that citizens don't really have great access to justice, particularly in Ireland. So it was really powerful when the Irish government was saying, well, you know, who is this NGO to bring this case on behalf of the public, to have a really packed courtroom with babies crawling on the floor, you know, while the right to life is being argued in front of everyone. I just thought it was really, really powerful. So that lasted for 4 days. And then we received our High Court judgment in September of last year. And unfortunately, we lost at the High Court level, which was the worst. It's great now. But oh my gosh, like this, yeah, that day was really a bad day. But it was still a significant judgment. It did have its strong points in that the judge acknowledged that climate change is a really serious issue. And the judge said that Friends of the Irish Environment should have a right to bring this case. So that was good, you know. And basically what it came down to was this doctrine called the separation of powers. So the government and the court operate independently of one another. So the court isn't meant to come up with the law, it just enforces it. And the judge was afraid that by ruling in this case in our favor, he would be taking on the role of the government, if that makes sense.
Like opening up the door to other cases, kind of.
Exactly. He thought that basically the government should have discretion in deciding what it does to respond to climate change. That, yeah, climate change is a serious issue, but how the government responds is its own business. So we strongly disagreed with that, and we decided to appeal the case. So when you do that, you immediately have a right of appeal to the Court of Appeals. But the process is really, really long. So we also tried to leapfrog the Court of Appeal and bring the case directly before the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court allowed us to, and it also gave us a 7-judge composition, which is really, really significant, because normally if you bring a case to the Supreme Court, you might have 3 judges and sometimes 5. But 7 Supreme Court judges is reserved for the cases of extreme like importance or complexity. And so our case was heard in the Supreme Court on the 22nd and 23rd of June this year. It wasn't actually on in the Supreme Court, it was on in the King's Inn's dining hall, which is quite surreal.
Social distancing.
Yeah, social distancing. So we were in this really fancy dining hall with like chandeliers and really ornate fireplaces.
Bizarre.
I know.
That's so surreal.
It was strange enough having all this happen during a pandemic. And then I think it just felt really funny to be in such an ornate place. I don't think they've ever had a hearing in there before, and I don't know if they ever will again. So there were 7 judges, and yeah, the hearing only lasted 2 days, which is such a limited time because, so you're trying to fit in the bulk of your arguments while being interrogated by 7 Supreme Court judges that can interrupt you at any point in time and decide to ask you anything they want. So But anyways, it lasted just 2 days, and that was in June. And then just over a month later, on the 31st of July, we received our judgment, and we really didn't expect to receive it so quickly at all. I think it does speak to the fact that the Supreme Court really do consider it an urgent issue. And we won! So, yeah, it was really, really amazing. And it was a unanimous judgment. So all seven judges completely agreed. We actually won on quite specific grounds. We won on the basis that the National Mitigation Plan didn't comply with Ireland's 2015 Climate Act. The government didn't specify how it was going to reduce Ireland's emissions when it passed that act into law. And so therefore it wasn't lawful. And while that might sound quite technical and legalistic, it actually has really, really significant practical implications. It means that governments, and particularly in wealthy countries like Ireland, need to reduce their emissions in the short term and need to specify how they will do so, or the courts will intervene, that it will be considered a breach of the law. So, yeah.
That's brilliant. I'm happy to hear that there's actual action happening on a climate action bill, because what you're saying there is like, oh, like all these meetings happening since like 94, and it's just like you're talking about it but you're not implementing it. So yay.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm going to interrupt you now and ask Mariam. So when we spoke to you before, Mariam, you had mentioned that actually, you know, human rights violations are going to be the biggest challenge, one of the biggest challenges that face Sierra Leone over the coming years. So maybe could you speak more to this and maybe explain the link between the current climate crisis and human rights violations in Sierra Leone?
Yes, sure. When I was mentioning that, I also had a look at the current situation in the country, because there is a general feeling of complete lack of accountability for past human rights violations, in addition to the ongoing and current environmental issues of Sierra Leone, such as, you know, deforestation, loss of soil fertility, water and air pollution due to repeated and ongoing extractive mineral resources. And those issues, environmental issues, are preventing people to enjoy their basic human rights. These extractive companies have regularly taken legal action in defamation proceedings against human rights defenders such as Joseph that we had in a podcast here. And also, these procedures are aiming at intimidating NGOs and journalists, silencing them and making them financially vulnerable. So to me, there is a clear link between our current climate crisis and human rights violations in Sierra Leone, because the environmental issues, the causes of the environmental issues are still pending, they are ongoing, and people are still struggling to get justice for that. And the abusive exploitation of the environment has a direct impact on the biodiversity and the livelihood, and unfortunately on the health of those living in these areas. So it means that until we get justice for those people, you know, until we get, you know, we are interested in regulating and also rolling the roots and the deep causes of climate crisis, we won't get justice for those people. So to me, there's a clear link between our current climate crisis and human rights violations in Sierra Leone.
Thanks, Mariam. It's so important to hear how everything is so interconnected. So now we actually want to ask you both the same question.
Yes, so we know that there are many tools in our kind of climate action toolbox to affect change. However, what do you think are the biggest barriers to genuine climate action? Mariam, we might go to you first in terms of kind of getting the perspective from Sierra Leone. What do you think are the biggest barriers?
Thank you. I think that to me, the biggest barriers to genuine climate action is the lack of education on climate change at the very early stage. I'm talking about schools, I'm talking about all the different areas on the society, because people are not really, we don't have the same level of understanding of the implication of this, of climate change. People don't necessarily know what it means. And even though we have laws, you know, and agreements, international conventions and international treaties that our states are part of, we don't necessarily see, you know, those laws translated within the population, because people still think in Africa, in Sierra Leone, and also in Africa generally, that climate change is a Western issue, and which is completely wrong, because we had so many incidents in the last, you know, years that clearly have, you know, an explanation and are clearly linked to me to climate change. But people don't necessarily do this link because they don't understand the issue, and also they are not educated on that. So to me, the biggest barrier to climate action is actually education about that.
It's actually interesting that you say that, because Clodagh, you mentioned to us that one of the Supreme Court judges, you can correct me if any of this is not correct, that they said that the National Mitigation Plan, just a normal person wouldn't be able to understand what is in that, you know, and just that kind of links with what you're saying, Mariam, in terms of education and for people to actually understand why it's important that our country is making a difference. It's not up to other people, you know, or other countries. Now, I mean, it is slightly imbalanced in terms of the developed countries doing more for what they have.
Ireland.
Yeah.
Really bad.
But Clodagh, from an Irish perspective, what do you think are the genuine, you know, barriers to climate action here?
And you're totally right, by the way. That's exactly what the Supreme Court said, is that any citizen should be able to look at a national mitigation plan and understand how the government is actually just reducing Ireland's emissions. The barriers to genuine climate action, I think, lie with the fact that the main perpetrators of the crisis are still profiting from the crisis. Just during the week, we heard news that ExxonMobil plans to blow the carbon budget completely, and because it is profitable to do so. So I think that, yeah, companies and particularly the fossil fuel industry remain a threat to whether or not we can sustain a habitable planet. And I think, as well, you know, how we actually, how do I say, basically, like how honest we are at actually seeing whether or not the actions that we're taking correspond with science and climate justice. That really requires very, you know, like there are all these terms, like, for example, Ireland's draft climate bill that came out a couple of days ago requires Ireland to transition to a so-called climate neutral economy by 2050, which is completely indefensible because Ireland has already contributed so disproportionately to the crisis. So it would mean not only that we had done that, but that we would consume a disproportionate amount of the remaining and rapidly depleting global budget, carbon budget, sorry, to remain within a 1.5 degree world. So I think education is actually really critical there, because the onus is on all of us to hold our leaders accountable, to not get away with using kind of tricky accountancy mechanisms like offsetting, or using, you know, ambiguous language like climate neutral, which doesn't really compel them to take enough action now. So I would totally agree with what Miriam said. We need greater education, and we need far greater accountability from those who can actually allow us to stay within a 1.5 degree world. That's also not to say that 1.5 degrees is safe or acceptable either. It's just the bare minimum that governments have agreed to comply with within the Paris Agreement.
We need to strive to that, not go anywhere above that.
Mm-hmm. Just to quickly jump in there, just to say, because I know when I first started out with kind of trying to get my head around everything, it was so hard, and this is from an education point of view, it was so hard to know where to begin. And I think I just wanted to flag, I don't know if you guys heard that my battery is now telling me that it's low, that Stop Climate Chaos have been excellent throughout all of this, because if it is about education and it's about explaining to people, you know, the process that you guys went through, but also interrogating that climate bill, we shouldn't just accept it because the government have just done this now. And, you know, it's obviously a great stepping stone, but we need to be kind of going through these things with a fine tooth comb. And Stop Climate Chaos, I have to give, you know, it, like, credit to them. They've been great at kind of communicating that, getting people on board. They have templates that you can just fill out really quickly and send it on to your, you know, your local TDs to be like, get your act together. You don't even have to write the thing yourself. So, you know, we need more groups like that, you know, making it easy. It's a click of a button, you know, it's sitting in on a webinar, like you were saying, Clodagh. You know, so it's just trying to make people feel like it is accessible, you know, and that it's not this kind of thing far away. It matters, and we all need to get involved. So sorry, that's my little soapbox.
No, I think that's great. I actually think, because like I'm like a visual learner, someone might be like very academic, so like having different NGOs coming together to be like, we've done this work for you, okay, or if you're just on socials, here's who to follow, like the information is there. Like I'm all about TikTok now. I can't, like, it is just such a platform to, like, yes, I'm an elder millennial, whatever, but like it connects so many people. If you're listening, people are laughing at me now, but it really is good. But yeah, education I think is key, and especially education for women. So it is no secret that the women are at the forefront of climate action, like when it comes to it. So I guess we wanted to ask both of you, what do you think? Why do you think it's so important to have women's voices heard, to have women as representatives of global leaders, just like general representation for women in a man's world? That's my question. So maybe we'll start with Mariam.
Unfortunately, we are living in a society in Africa where land rights is a taboo subject. And due to the socially constructed roles and existing inequalities and patriarchal norms, women are the ones who have the most to lose in terms when, you know, we will reach effectively this climate change. We are already seeing, perceiving the effects, and especially women in remote areas are unfortunately the most impacted by climate and environmental issues. Because most of the time, they are the ones who work on the land. They sell the products of this land to take care of the family. But interestingly, they have less control and access to land and natural resources management than men, because women are often excluded from formal ownership of land. And in some cultures, women cannot even inherit from, you know, the land from the parents. So that means that there is a complete lack of access to decision making and the representation for environmental women, human rights defenders. So it's really important to educate women about the climate crisis, create and allow them in spaces where they can express their challenges, because they are the most, you know, they are the people at the front line and needs. They need to express the challenges they need. And also, most importantly, we need to promote an equal access to the management of natural resources and the preservation of the environment. Because women are, of course, men do, but women are respectful of the environment. The environment, the land is, you know, giving the
Mother Nature.
subsistential means, and also taking care of, you know, the health, the well-being, because we are also, we have traditional medicines from this same land. So it's really important to empower them on such great and key topics like climate crisis. We also need to ensure the active participation in women in environmental decision makings at all levels. Why don't we have groups of women, you know, attending those big conventions, meetings, you know, COP21, all those climate meetings, all those key areas where decisions, big decisions are made. Why don't we open those spaces to women who are directly impacted by this issue? So this is really areas that we should look into, and we definitely need to empower women on this topic of climate change.
Yes, all about it. And then Clodagh, what do you think? I mean, obviously, I'm assuming you agree.
Yeah, I totally agree. As Miriam was saying, women are systemically underrepresented in international climate talks and in government quite generally. And I think it's so important to include women in these decisions as well, because when we talk about, you know, the transition to a zero emissions economy, care work actually is a really important element of that. And that is made up predominantly by female workers. And care work is already low carbon, but unfortunately at the moment it isn't valued enough. And that's something that we can really work towards, you know, making the transition a very feminist transition and making sure that we actually value the work that women do proportionately.
No, I think that is spot on. I suppose just to kind of get an idea of, Miriam, for you firstly, you know, as we've said, I feel like we're making a tagline for you, Miriam, the incredible woman who doesn't sleep. But in terms of kind of what motivates you to do the amount of work that you do on a daily basis, what is it that gives you that kind of oomph or that punch to just keep going? Because I would like whatever you're taking.
Wow, that's a really great question. I always tell myself that, you know, change cannot come by itself. And we have to work for it. We have to bring it. And until some of us and some people like you, like Clodagh, Climate Case Ireland, and also, you know, generally Climate Queens, until people like you stand up and take actions for what we strongly believe in, nothing will change. So that's mainly what keeps me going every day, because at some point I'm like, I find that I'm really privileged compared to many other women in this continent. And I just felt like I couldn't just, you know, sleep on those privileges while people don't have access, don't have the needs, don't have the platforms, you know, to freely for themselves. So that keeps me, you know, going, and also encourage me to stand up and work, you know, fearlessly, to help those people in need. Because I strongly believe that we don't have the same access, you know, we don't have the same tools, the same possibilities, the same opportunities. So those who are gifted should be in a position to help others. We cannot speak for themselves.
Well, I think you are amazing, Miriam, and I think you are an incredible role model for so many women in your country. I know you're laughing, but I'm being serious. You are incredible. And, you know, Clodagh, just to kind of get from your perspective in terms of what motivates you, because I'm sure, you know, when that all happened in the High Court and you guys were left so disappointed, you know, it's like, how do you kind of pick yourself back up and kind of stay motivated and go again, you know, because that must have been really tough.
So I completely agree with Miriam's response and would like to endorse all her responses as my own. So yeah, I kind of, like, we always said that we didn't really know how the case was going to go, but that we have truth on our side and that hopefully we'll eventually have justice on our side as well. And in addition to that, I have to say that the people I work with really, really inspire me. They're just so amazing. I every day I'm just kind of awed by what the people around me are doing. And so that's kind of like at my local immediate level. And then also, you know, on an international level, I just think it's incredible that this work is being done by people all around the world. And I think being able to make those connections, I find that that really is really powerful as well. So being able to be a part of this conversation is just really incredible. This alone should be enough to motivate anyone. And also, even, you know, earlier today we received an email from a group in Brazil that are doing similar work. I think being able to just connect with people that have the same vision and values is really, really good to keep the motivation going.
I love that. Thank you both. That reminds me of, like, I've been on my own climate journey and just starting off, and I think I was in some groups and it was like, you know, I was trying to be more intersectional, getting everyone's perspectives, and there were so many people that were like, oh, I'd never tell my friends that I was at a group like this. And I was like, no, you have, like, this is where you have to, like, push yourself out of your comfort zone, because, like, most of us here in Ireland aren't even seeing the effects of, like, the changing climate, but we're creating it. So we really got to step it up. And, you know, for me, I'm like, this inspires me. But I think our final question for you both, so we've been asking everyone in our series, what is the one thing you would like to see happen in the next decade to create real change to benefit the environment? So this can be on a global scale, on a local scale, but just one thing you'd like to see happen. So we'll start with you, Clodagh.
I think I'd like to see the government have a legal obligation to reach a zero emissions country by 2030. And that in doing so, we'd have really, really strict carbon budgets, and where we'd have a climate change advisory council that would produce monthly emission gap reports. So that each month we would see, is there a difference between where we are and where we need to be? How do we bridge that gap so that the present government can't just keep passing it on to future governments? I think, yeah, if I can just have one, I just, maybe that.
No, that's good. That makes sense. Okay. And it's a tangible thing. And I like that you got a timeline going on there. You know, if anyone's listening, it's very achievable.
Yeah.
And so, Mariam, same question to you. So one thing you'd like to see in the next decade for real environmental change.
Thank you, Chloe. I know you asked me for one thing, but I'm going to give you two. So for me, I would love to see a better coordination to bring together civil society organizations, civil society movements working on climate change and environmental issues, having women's groups, to create those sharing and exchanging platforms. Because I find that the work that Clodagh have been doing with Climate Case Ireland is so important. And what they have been able to achieve is so amazing that other people, other countries should benefit from the experience. So it's really important to have our own platforms, you know, different from the sharing, the spaces that the leaders have on climate. So we should have also civil society movements or organizations having their own platforms to exchange, you know, to share success stories, as the case of Climate Case Ireland, and also exchange, you know, share best practices, because what has worked in Ireland, I'm sure that it can be duplicated and adapted in the Sierra Leone and other countries' context. So it's really important to have a better coordination, to have those platforms, you know, to bring everybody on board, to bring everybody together, to make strong commitments and raise more awareness. This is one. And the second thing that I would like to see is a real change of behavior led by the commitment, the personal commitment of governments and political decision makers, because the urgency is there, the need is there, because climate change is a serious issue and it concerns all of us. And until we don't take it personally, we won't be able to change anything. So we really need more personal commitments at the government level, but also at the political decision-making level as well. So more specific laws protecting the environment and more personal commitment. Thank you.
Mariam for president. Yes. Love that. So wherever you are listening today, take that advice. There's nothing stopping you listening now to like set up that your own campaign. Like if you want to get in touch with Clodagh, I guess where would be the best place to find you, Clodagh, on Climate Case Ireland?
Yeah,
would it be on Twitter?
We're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, and you can also email us at info@climatecaseireland.ie.
Amazing. And you can follow them on Twitter at climatecaseire. And then Mariam, the same question, please. How can people get in touch with you if they're so moved by what you're saying today?
So it's really easy. You just have to go on our website, Frontline Defenders, and contact us. And, you know, I should your message will reach out to me. So it's really easy. And also you can follow me on Twitter, Mariam Sawadogo. And that's it. Thank you.
Amazing. And so Mariam's tag is Mariam S06. So really, thank you both so much for joining us today. Like, this has been lovely. This is our first video session. So, you know, we're adapting. But really just want to say massive thank you for your time and for speaking with us. And I'm sure both of your stories have, you know, made a difference to someone listening today. And, you know, even if it's a small change, I think from everything we've heard, it really does make a difference. So thank
absolutely.
You guys.
Absolutely. And guys, don't forget to check out the other events happening online for the Dublin Arts and Human Rights Festival today and also tomorrow. You can also follow Smashing Times and Frontline Defenders on Twitter at @smashing_times, and Frontline Defenders are Frontline HRD on Twitter. But honestly, Mariam, Clodagh, thank you so much. I just love speaking to you. I feel like we could talk for hours. Just put on the kettle, make some more tea.
Thank you so much.
But it was an absolute pleasure. Thank you, guys.